are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, October 9th, 2019. I'm Michael Brooks on a hybrid Sam and Michael Wednesday. We are broadcasting live from the steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, an interview with former North Carolina Democratic Congressman Brad Miller on his really extensive defining work on the history of the House's oversight of the executive branch and its failures and the pushes to make the executive branch less and less accountable. How did we get to where we are today in terms of this stunning overreach? Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan has announced that he is moving into northern Syria. They've begun shelling. This move comes, I should also add, just weeks after the United States pressured Syrian Kurdish forces, SDF forces, to drop their border positions with the renewed commitment that they would, in fact, be protecting them. The Pentagon won't take over Islamic State prisons if U.S. allied Kurdish forces withdraw, officials say. There's serious criticisms about who we're calling whistleblowers and what started this process. They're legitimate, but also Donald Trump is in full and utter contempt of Congress. They are saying they will not cooperate in any way, shape, or form. What remotely serious thing is left to do besides jailing and fining these people? Trump's lawyers argue that unanimous Watergate case was wrongly decided. And former South Carolina Rep. Trey Gowdy has returned to the national scene as a member of Donald Trump's legal team. Trump told Rick Perry and State Department officials as early as May to talk with Giuliani about Ukraine. And half of voters support impeaching and removing Trump. Those numbers keep moving up. Indigenous protesters and others have converged on the capital of Quito, taking on the horrific Lenin Moreno administration, who ran center-left and has governed far-right. He moved him and the top military brass, himself and top military brass, outside of the capital. The U.S. imposes visa restrictions on Chinese officials over Uyghur human rights abuses. Alabama capital elects Stephen Reed, its first black mayor in a 200-year history. And unpaid bills rack up in Trump rally's wake, even as a new batch of documents reveal the conflict between Philadelphia's DA, reform DA Larry Krasner, and Pennsylvania's Attorney General. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. We're going to get to the ad in a second. And then this really important interview with Brad Miller. I'd recommend, if you have time, you read his piece in the American Prospect as well. Very important piece on the executive branch and congressional accountability. Bernie Sanders is up. He's walking. It should be noted that in addition to this episode with his heart, his daughter-in-law just died of cancer. She was only 46 years old. It was basically diagnosed and then an incredibly fast process. This family is going through a lot. And, you know, this is one of the few people in American politics that, frankly, we can look back and see and, you know, witness him as actually a decent person. that incredibly powerful crowdsourced ad or grassroots ad documenting the difference between the just utterly grotesque media coverage of Bernie Sanders versus what he's actually doing on the trail. Please, everybody, watch. Now, this guy still crushed the last quarter in fundraising. It's still a three-way race, and he's cutting back on his schedule. We're going to play this clip, and then I'll contextualize it.
Do you expect when you do start to travel more that you'll be able to keep up the same type of robust?
No, I don't know. I think not certainly immediately. Look, we were doing, you know, in some cases, five or six meetings a day, you know, three or four rallies and town meetings, and meeting with groups of people. I don't think I'm going to do that. But I certainly intend to be actively campaigning. I think we're going to change the nature of the campaign a bit. Make sure that I have the strength to do what I have to do.
What do you mean by change of nature?
Well, probably not doing four rallies a day. I'm not quite sure that I could be wrong on this, but I don't know there's anybody who did more rallies than we have done all over the state. So we're going to, you know, probably not do three or four rallies a day, do two or do other events as well.
So that's true. There's no other candidate, including ones that are significantly younger than Sanders, who have remotely the schedule that he has kept up. And keep in mind that, you know, he's hasn't broke pace since campaigning 2016, then trying his utmost to elect Hillary Clinton president, then working to kill the Republicans' healthcare efforts to destroy the ACA, which he was actually a leader in the fight against, then in the midterms, and now assembling this groundbreaking, grassroots, unparalleled presidential race, in addition to a serious legislative agenda, including more work to end the genocide in Yemen than anyone else, as well as an attempt to actually restore some congressional oversight of foreign policy, which has just been decimated in the last several decades. So no one's kept up a more thorough schedule and done more than Bernie Sanders in the game. I think that, you know, this is objectively a setback, but he is objectively still very much in the race. And the dialectic that we have to establish is between the fact, and look, this is the reason I'm not messing around. This is why I'm not, you know, I'm not playing with Warren or Gabbard or Yang or whatever. This is an unparalleled left campaign. And if you profess to care about those things, whether it be on foreign policy or the most thoroughgoing domestic policy, you have just, I mean, it's just an unparalleled candidate. Nothing's been offered like this in modern American politics on every major issue. So we need to work incredibly hard. And I think that this is also where the not me, us dimension comes in as well. But take heart, and I look forward to the debate. Now, speaking of taking heart, who loves reading ads more than Sam Cedar? Watch Sam read an ad to you.
Thank you, Michael. Folks, if you feel like you can't find the time to read all the books on your list, guess what? I'm right there with you. My list of books to read is so large, I don't have time to do it because basically I'm reading books for this show. And even then, I don't even get to read 100% of those. Well, Blinkist is an app that compiles the key takeaways from thousands of nonfiction books. Everything you need to know is condensed down to 15 minutes that you can either read or, my favorite, listen to on the app. Blinkist is really unique, and it works on your phone, on your tablet, on your web browser, wherever. You're going to find everything from health and self-help titles to history and business books included in Blinkist library. And I'll tell you, okay, so I've already said in the past, Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Workweek, right? And I listen to that. And I'll listen to random business stuff. But the thing I like the best about Blinkist, because there are some books like LC, like I want to read that one, right? Some of the history books, those are books that, you know, that you want to dig into. For me personally, other people might just want to know the bullet points on these history things. That's all well and good. But for me, it's stuff like this. queued up for me next is How to Make People Like You in 90 Seconds or Less. By Nicholas Boothman. Now, no offense, Nicholas Boothman, but I just don't know I would read that book because, like, I just don't, you know, it seems a little bit like I don't know if I want to be, you know, on the subway trying to figure, you know, with the book there. But also, it's, I just don't know, with all the amount of time that I have, I don't know that I'm going to spend that time to just try and get people to like me in 90 seconds or less. But it's going to take me 13 minutes to listen to this. On my walk to work, I could listen to it twice and still have time left over to meet three people who will like me in 90 seconds or less. That's what I love about Blinkist. And with Blinkist, you get unlimited access to read or listen to a massive library of condensed nonfiction books. All the books you want, one low price. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer for our listeners. Go to Blinkist.com/majority. Try it for free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, Blinkist.com/majority to start your 7-day free trial and save 25% off. 25% off. Blinkist.com/majority. Check it out. Now, let's take a quick break. When we come back, I'll be talking to Brad Miller, former U.S. representative for North Carolina's 13th Congressional District, serving from 2003 to 2013. He's written a piece in The American Prospect, The 40-Year War, William Barr's Long Struggle Against Congressional Oversight. Be right back.
I'm just picturing Sam walking, just being like, and a very good day to you too, sir. I listen to my new Blinkist. How do you happen to be? Okay. This is Sam with former Congressman Brad Miller.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program former U.S. Representative for North Carolina's 13th Congressional District, serving from 2003 to 2013, and writing in the fall 2019 The American Prospect, The 40-Year War, William Barr's Long Struggle Against Congressional Oversight. Welcome to the program, Brad.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
I have to tell you that in addition to reliving some of my youth in terms of your piece, the thing that really struck me, and we'll get into it in more detail, but I just have to say off the top, is the Office of Legal Counsel, I did not have a sense of how messed
powerful.
Up of an yeah how powerful well I
and
did
sinister.
Have a sense of how powerful but how like so easy it is to corrupt it in some ways. But let's before we get there, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, but you write that William Barr, this has been a part of, and he is part of, a 40-year project to essentially strengthen the power of the president. I imagine that's been an ongoing battle since day one on some level, but there's been, we've entered into a new era of it.
We have. And I think for Trump, it's, you know, it's obviously not doctrinal. It's entirely opportunistic. He doesn't think about constitutional architecture, which is the phrase that constitutional scholars use for separation of powers and checks and balances. It is entirely in his interest at the moment. So he thinks about it as much as my dog thinks about whether to lick his own penis.
Right.
It serves his immediate needs. What's to think about? But for Barr and for others on the right, there has been a consistent plan, a consistent effort over the last 40 years at least, to create a very powerful executive and a very weak, well, really both the courts and Congress lose power to the president under their interpretation and their preferred constitution, their preferred political system, their system of government, but especially Congress.
Well, I want to dig into the various examples over the course of these 40 years that you talk about. But I felt sort of mystified, and I knew vaguely about Bill Barr and his involvement back in the Iran-Contra days. But
right. When
that 16-page memo of his that he wrote, saying that Trump was really incapable of being investigated or at least held to account because he was president. I mean, since that time, I've been sort of baffled about, here's a guy who's retired. Who is it? I mean, is it, where does this doctrine come from? I mean, like, where does, is he part of some type of like secret Straussian cult? I mean, what, like honestly, like, I just like wonder, like, I don't understand that type of belief set. Right.
Yeah, and I don't think they all get together in secret and perform rituals, but there is almost a cult-like belief in a strong executive, and it really the line between the very strong executive elected by the people and strongman rule is really a pretty blurry line. And the idea of democracy, that government derives its just powers from the consent of the governed, was a radical idea back then in the 18th century, and it's still a radical idea. And not everyone accepts it. And it's a radical idea of the left, not of the right.
People should remember that, originally senators were not popularly elected and so on.
And actually, neither were presidents. I mean, they fully expected the Electoral College to be a deliberative body. They did not think it was logistically possible to elect presidents by popular vote, because there's no way in the world someone from Georgia would know anything about someone from New York.
Right. I mean, on some level, like, that makes sense to me in terms of like a certain practicality. It's just hard for me to imagine that there are people who feel like the best thing for America is for us to have a, you know, quasi dictator type of situation.
A man on horseback. Yes.
But those people exist. So we got to take them at their word. Let's go back. I mean, you cite through, you know, some early history ranging from George Washington's first term to Woodrow Wilson saying that informing function of Congress should be preferred even to its legislative function. In other words, things like oversight and whatnot. And really, this turn really happened under the Reagan administration. Lay out for us, like, you know, how it was that Reagan assembled these people, but it really goes back. I mean, before this, right? Where Dick Cheney sort of, learned this concept under Nixon.
Right. Yeah, it goes back to the Nixon administration, and Nixonian has become a term used for extreme claims of presidential power. And after Watergate, there were reforms, important reforms. The Inspector General statute, which is what led us to the Ukraine scandal and the possibility now of the very real possibility of impeachment, was a post-Watergate reform. So was the special counsel law. There were a lot of there were several important reforms that were designed to rein in the imperial presidency. And for Barr and for Edwin Meese and for others who were part of that group of rightist lawyers who came into the Reagan administration, both in the White House and in the Department of Justice, there was a sense that the Watergate reforms had gone way too far, and that the just powers, the proper powers of the presidency needed to be reformed, needed to be restored. But in fact, they went much beyond that. Edwin Meese gave speeches that suggested that the president could disregard opinions of the Supreme Court with which he disagreed, that independent agencies were an intrusion on the president's power over the executive branch, despite Supreme Court cases saying that independent agencies within the executive branch were perfectly okay. And that was sort of where this began, was with the Reagan administration, and they began picking fights that went badly for them at first.
All right. Well, let's talk about those fights, because the first one was a function of executive privilege. Now,
Yeah.
Where did, I mean, this concept of executive privilege, did this come out of case law? I mean, where does this derived? Because, you know, it over the course of the inquiries into Donald Trump, we've seen a lot of times where the executive does not seem to be calling for executive privilege, but those working for him cite it, even though it has not been initiated, I guess. They just sort of like think they shouldn't talk about it. Just give us a little background on executive privilege, and then we can go into the attempt by the EPA to withhold documents from Congress back in the early 80s.
It's pretty ill-defined. Presidents in the 20th century, I think Franklin Roosevelt and Dwight Eisenhower, both said that they would instruct employees, officials of the executive branch, not to answer certain questions that went to their communications with the president, that the confidentiality of communications with the president so the president could make decisions with the best advice because the advice was uninhibited. I mean, that's been around for a while. It has not really been recognized by the courts until the Watergate cases and the Nixon administration, I guess one in particular. And it's never really been very well defined. But the court has acknowledged that there probably are some communications between some high-level officials and the president that should be regarded as privileged. But even that is subject to being overridden if there is an obvious need for the information. And they do. And in my experience as an oversight subcommittee chair for 4 years, the executive does just throw that out there anytime they don't want to answer a question. But early on in the Reagan administration, there was a scandal that came out of the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. The head then was Ann Gorsuch Burford. Yes, she is Neil Gorsuch's mother, or was. And she was head of it, and it was a question about the Superfund, the legislation to clean up waste sites, particularly contaminated waste sites. And there was a question about whether there was corruption and how that program was being administered and the funds were being spent. And a couple, three House committees got whistleblower information and issued subpoenas. And the Reagan administration folks at the White House and the DOJ told her not to provide the information but to assert executive privilege. And then they had litigation over that, and the court said this is not the time to raise this. The time to raise this is when she is defending the criminal charges for contempt of Congress. And she said, what? What was this about criminal charges? And she just folded. And they lost that battle. They lost it pretty resoundingly, and Congress got all the documents. The person under Gorsuch, who her name was Rita Lavelle, who had headed the Superfund program, ended up being fired, then convicted of perjury, and she served an active prison sentence for perjury for what she had said to Congress. And then the House, the Judiciary Committee, opened an investigation into how the Department of Justice had handled their investigation and whether they had obstructed, the Department of Justice had obstructed the House investigation, and whether high officials in the Department of Justice had committed perjury in fighting the investigation. So things just kind of unraveled for the Reagan administration in their attempt to put Congress in their place at the time.
Well, I mean, you know, the idea of someone lying to Congress and going to jail for it, the idea of Congress investigating the Department of Justice, those things seem so far removed from where we are today because, you know, what you're outlining is like I feel like this happened, all this stuff happened like, I don't know, 2 years ago under this president, right? I mean, we have the EPA refusing to hand over documents, it feels like, every couple of weeks. We've seen people just in their nomination hearings lie to Congress. I mean, but yet we have none of those. I mean, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, but these tools seem to have gone away.
Well, I've wondered about that. Why is it so different now that they can just thumb their nose at Congress, just flout Congress's oversight powers? And you know, this my article in American Prospect was written before the whole Ukraine stuff hit. But every day are new examples of what I wrote about in the American Prospect piece. I think one important thing that has changed, in addition just the change in the norms and how tribal the partisanship is now and how much negative partisanship there is, because I don't necessarily like my guys, but I hate your guys, is that the special counsel law enacted after Watergate sunset at the end of the Clinton administration, the beginning of the George W. Bush administration, because Democrats by that point hated it because of how many investigations right. there had been under Clinton, and the Republicans had always hated it. It had been what had brought the Iran-Contra stuff to light and made it impossible for the Bush administration, the George H.W. Bush administration, to make that go away. And the old law had a hair trigger requirement to report upon demand by Congress, at least a report any evidence of possible criminal misconduct by executive branch officials to the District of Columbia federal court to appoint a special prosecutor, so the special prosecutor would investigate and perhaps prosecute because of a possible conflict of interest. That's expired.
And, that, and to be clear, that was the independent counsel law. We can still have special counsels, but those are appointed by the Department of Justice like we had with Robert Mueller.
Sorry, okay, yes. It was called an independent counsel law. That's correct. And they were appointed by the court itself. The Department of Justice had to provide them resources, but they acted independently with all the powers of the Department of Justice, and that expired. And, you know, in the Ann Gorsuch-Burford matter, the Department of Justice said, we don't have to prosecute her. I mean, the statute says that we have to, but we don't have to. It's an inherent power of the president to prosecute or not. But there was sitting out there that independent counsel law, and Congress could have required the court to appoint a special prosecutor, an independent counsel, to proceed or not. And that's expired. And I think since then, and certainly what is happening now, everyone involved knows there's no way in the world the Department of Justice, the bar Department of Justice, is going to bring anybody, is going to file a complaint against anybody for ignoring a subpoena from any committee of Congress except one maybe headed by Lindsey Graham. And so they aren't worried about criminal prosecution. Nobody's worried about going to jail. And so they thumb their nose at Congress. You can't send us to jail. You can't do anything to us. Screw you.
And we should say that back in, I guess it was in 88, prior to that, but just in that era you're talking about, Congress had basically floated the idea of an appointment of independent counsel for possible criminal charges against Ted Olson.
Yes.
Who was...
And just floated it. They had, in fact, done it. And the D.C. court had appointed a special, a independent counsel. And Olson, and they were just spoiling for the fight. Olson and the others, the other rightists in the administration, they were spoiling for the chance to challenge the constitutionality of the independent counsel law because, from their point of view, just every syllable of the law was an intrusion on the president's constitutional powers. And they moved to quash the subpoena that had been issued to Ted Olson and to declare the independent counsel law unconstitutional. It went to the Supreme Court, and they got their asses handed to them. It was a 7-1 decision. I think Kennedy had just been appointed to the court, and he didn't participate. But it was by Rehnquist. And Rehnquist said, no problem here. There's an inherent conflict of interest. And looking back at the history of the Constitutional Convention, they were the delegates and those others at the time were did not want that strong a president, an unchecked president, and they did want there to be even if circumstances suggested there's a reason for it. Inter-branch appointments, so that Congress could appoint people who would serve in the executive branch, which just to the Reaganites, to the rightist in the administration, was just apostasy. I mean, they got clobbered, and the only one who voted with them, went with them, was Scalia.
So, okay, so this sets the table. Obviously, the Democrats allowed this law to lapse because in the wake of the Clinton years.
Yeah. It was a Ken Starr thing, but it's not just that. Like, everybody in the administration at some point had a special counsel and racked up tens or maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars of attorney's fees in defending it, in defending the investigations, and a lot of them had very badly damaged reputations. And there was a sense that it had gone too far, but they went from there to nothing.
Right. The baby was thrown out of the bathwater because let's talk about the OLC here, because I didn't realize that Rehnquist, you said Barr followed Rehnquist, Scalia, and Olson as the head of the OLC. Wait, all of them were on the head of the OLC? They were all heads of the OLC at one point. That's just nuts to me. I mean, it really, because I guess I have had just a, you know, obviously, John, you in the Bush administration with the torture memos and that to me was, I guess, was always framed by the media at the time as sort of an aberration, that it was like you know, that it was a one off, and it seems like once the special counsel, or I should say the independent counsel law, sunsets, the OLC just becomes completely ripe for some type of corruption, because there's no way to hold anybody to account if the OLC and the DOJ essentially do not see themselves as an independent watchdog of the president.
Correct. And even after an administration changes, it would be very, very difficult to bring a criminal prosecution against someone who had disobeyed the law during the previous administration if there was an OLC, Office of Legal Counsel, opinion saying that you were doing the right thing, that the statute that you were ignoring is unconstitutional, so you should do what the president tells you, and it's essentially a get-out-of-jail-free card. It's like a prospective pardon for conduct that has not yet been committed. And yes, the potential for abuse there is enormous. And yes, that potential has been fully realized repeatedly for the last 30 years.
Okay. Well, let's talk about, what Barr's role in this. So after the, Reagan administration loses in all of their attempts, like what, and specifically, the Rehnquist decision that you can have, you know, the independent counsel law is no problem. Barr then sort of steps in at that point. And what does he do to sort of limit that? I mean, this is really sort of the beginning of the end on some level, even though we have to wait until after the Clinton administration to get rid of that law.
Yeah, well, he became the first head of the OLC, the Office of Legal Counsel, in the George H.W. Bush administration, and less than a year after the decision on the independent counsel law, Morrison v. Olson. He wrote an opinion as head of OLC, a memorandum that was distributed widely through the executive branch, that said, I think the name of it was 10 common congressional intrusions on presidential power, or something like that. But it was a very belligerent, militant memo that Congress by statute is intruding on presidential power, and we need to be on the watch for it, and we need to resist it. And the way to resist it isn't by challenging it in court or by vetoing laws, which could be overridden by Congress. It is by simply ignoring it. And really, all of the language from that memo has continued to show, even though that memo was supposedly pulled back in the Clinton administration, that memo has become kind of the touchstone for just about every claim of executive power by the right wing since then.
I mean, isn't that claim basically you and what army?
Pretty much, yeah. They can't do nothing about it, so we can do what we want. I mean, it's kind of given a higher tone. it sounds more principled, but you know that's basically it. Yeah, they can't challenge us. We're the ones who enforce the laws, and they can say what they want, but we're not going to enforce the law against ourselves. And once they pass their laws, they're done with it, and we decide what it means and whether to enforce it or not.
So, I mean, let's skip ahead here to present day. Once Barr introduces that concept, and he introduces that concept even before the independent counsel law is gone. So not only has he then established, like, we don't have to listen to anybody else. He what happens ultimately after the Clinton years, and maybe I don't know. I mean, I'm this is complete conjecture on my part, but I wonder if part of this push to sort of prove to the Democrats, like, you don't want this independent counsel law because we're going to abuse the heck out of it, was to get rid of it. Because at that point, then there's no other vehicle.
I think it was probably that. Well, that may be true, but it was also just opportunistic. They were trying to do damage, as Hillary Clinton's famous phrase was, a vast right-wing conspiracy. They were seizing upon anything that smelled slightly wrong, and suggesting that there was evidence of criminal wrongdoing, and asked for a special counsel, and a great many were appointed. But you know what the piece in American Prospect does lay out a lot of what the OLC opinions claimed in the George W. Bush administration, when I think it was really being pushed by Cheney and who was the other, Addison Adder?
Yes, Addison, yes.
Addison, yeah. I mean, if you saw the movie Vice, I think those guys were just as sinister as they were portrayed in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and you know, you get in a little bit into the Attorney General firing scandal. I mean, this all has to do with the politicization of the Department of Justice.
Right.
But the OLC, to me, the corrupting of that process, I think, is the most problematic, because there's this, and people should understand, the Office of Legal Counsel, just to be clear, it basically functions as the DOJ's in-house Supreme Court. Right.
Right.
I mean,
right.
They decide, except for they don't have to grant cert, and they don't have to, it's just like, we have a question on the legality of doing this. Let's go down the hall, and Bill will tell us at OLC if we can do it or not. They'll write up a memo. They get together. They figure out, you know, theoretically what the legal argument is, but there's no way to question it.
Right.
So it really doesn't matter how flimsy it all is.
And we, in fact, don't know what most opinions say, because a very small percentage are published.
I mean, this is a really messed up way of doing it. So let me ask you, I have two questions. I mean, one is in the immediate term, where obviously laws that were passed by a Democratic Congress would not be passed by a Republican Senate. What power does the Congress have? I mean, if they had the ability before to appoint an independent counsel, which could then put into legal jeopardy these various players who might say, like, hey, I'm not going to jail for Donald Trump or whoever it is. They don't have that ability anymore. What ability do they have that you perceive them as not using? Is it just inherent contempt?
No, I don't think so. And I promised Dave Day, and I'll write another piece for American Prospect on what I think the reforms coming out of this ought to be that are comparable to the post-Watergate reforms. I think there's a Supreme Court case, and in fact a long tradition, and a recent Ninth Circuit decision that says that courts have the inherent power to appoint a special prosecutor for contempt of court, because contempt of court is so important to the court's ability to exert his own power, that they can't depend upon the president. So if they turn it over to the executive branch and the executive branch says, no, we're not going to prosecute that, then the court can appoint an independent counsel to prosecute it for them. I think that, one, they ought to try that now. They ought to petition the court and say, look at this Supreme Court decision on contempt of court. The same thing should apply to contempt of Congress. Appoint a special process, an independent counsel. But even if they don't do that, or if they try that and they don't win, they ought to enact a statute, a narrower independent counsel statute for contempt of Congress, perjury before Congress, false statements to Congress, obstruction of congressional investigations, conspiracy to do any of that, because it's very clear that the executive branch cannot be made to do that if they are willing to take the political consequences of not doing it, and which, of course, the Trump administration is doing. And the Trump administration is ignoring all congressional subpoenas. And people who aren't even in the administration. There are these two Russians who were the guys who introduced Giuliani to Ukrainian officials who've been subpoenaed for a congressional investigation. They said, nah, we're not going to give you documents. We're not going to show up. Get the Department of Justice to prosecute us. Good luck with that.
Right.
And that, you know, that's got to change, because until that changes, Congress has effectively no oversight power. And I introduced legislation to do that a decade ago. And on the OLC, Russ Feingold introduced in the Senate, and I introduced a companion to the same bill in the House that would have required, with certain narrow exceptions, opinions by the Office of Legal Counsel be published so we could know what they're telling, what they're saying their powers are, at the very least, so Congress can do something about it. And I would go further now, and I would say that an opinion of the Office of Legal Counsel, you cannot say that you relied upon that in a criminal prosecution, as a defense in a criminal prosecution. And that would greatly cut in, I think, to the abuses of the OLC law, the role of the OLC.
Well,
a set of House members, I should tell you who they are, it's somewhat bipartisan. I can't remember who they are, but it's within the last 2 weeks, has introduced legislation very like what Russ Feingold and I introduced a decade ago.
Interesting. And what of inherent contempt? I mean, assuming that Congress doesn't pass anything in the short term, can Nancy Pelosi say, all right, we're doing this. You don't Mike Pompeo, you don't give us the documents. I'm sending the sergeant at arms to go out and put you in the Congress, the congressional dungeon or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Or we're just going to, you're going to rack up $2,000 a day in fines. And at one point, we're going to go to court and you can roll the dice. Because maybe in a year you're going to owe, you know, I don't know, $300,000 or something.
Yeah. There's also legislation to do that, I think. I'm not sure it's been introduced, but there's independent group, something like Good Government Now, I think is the name of it, proposed it, but with a limit of $25,000 for a civil fine. And that was part of the bill that I introduced a decade ago as well, to allow civil fines. The problem with inherent contempt with executive branch officials is you're sending out the Capitol Police and the Sergeant at Arms to take somebody into custody who's got protection by law enforcement officers from the executive branch. And I really don't like the idea of a firefight, an armed confrontation between the Capitol Police and the FBI or the Secret Service. There's got to be a better way to do it than that. But with respect to others who aren't in the executive branch, and both of them, by the way, would be assuming that they were taking orders, proper orders from above.
Right.
The Capitol Police to take somebody in custody, the Secret Service not to allow someone to be taken into custody. But with respect to others, I have suggested within the last year during this confrontation that like the accounting firm Lazars use inherent contempt against them, and they haven't been saying they won't turn over stuff. I mean, the non-government officials are saying, yeah, you just, of course, just tell us what to do and we'll do it. We have got no interest in going to jail over this. But there are problems. There are limits to inherent contempt. There are obviously. And by the way, I thought Jerry Nadler got unfairly criticized for not doing more about Corey Lewandowski's testimony, where, you know, he was just a thug, thumbed his nose. And there isn't anything that's equivalent to a bench warrant. There was no way that Jerry could have said to the sergeant at arms, okay, go detain him until his attitude is improved, and then we'll hear his testimony. There really isn't a way to do that. But there should be a way to get at least some potential witnesses in a way that they have to worry about it.
Yeah, well, I hope at the very least what comes out of that is some type of reform package for this that passes in Congress. Well, it's a fascinating piece, and would love to have you back on when you do write that piece for the American Prospect on the solutions. Former Representative Brad Miller, the piece is Thank you. 40-Year War. In the American Prospect, we'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much again for your time.
All right. Thanks, Sam. All right.
Welcome back to the show, folks. Check out that piece in the American Prospect. Very good. Very important. We're going to go to the fun half.
Check out Donald Barr's dad.
Oh, most definitely. And I would also put in a search right along Bill Barr's dad. I would put
Donald
Barr.
No, Bill Barr. I'm sorry.
Right along. Yeah, Donald. Bill Barr is, yeah, Donald Barr. Sounds like he looks like Donald Barr. Actually, the best line I ever, I don't usually, this isn't usually my humor zone. And of course, now F the Queer Eye show because of their trash about Bernie. But somebody said that they showed these photos side by side and they said Bill Barr looks like Steve Bannon after a Queer Eye makeover, which is just like. Exactly true. They completely nailed it.
I still, with respect, you know, putting aside their terrible politics, I do think that a national makeover policy would be good for, you know, to deal with alienation. That's what everybody needs. Is just,
oh, I no, that show is all about the outsourcing of dealing with mass atomization,
right,
and loneliness in the society. And it's actually really intense and painful because basically so many people just need a little bit of that.
I've cried multiple times at that show.
The outsourcing of emotional labor to feminized folks, shall we say?
I mean,
people who are not straight cis men, typically more of that care work is shifted onto them.
Well, it's the next phase of TMBS. Men are going to go help people clean up their bathrooms.
Yeah, jumpsuits.
Yeah. Adidas tracksuit.
You got
Let's
two
meditate.
Routes.
Let's hug each other. We're all good, man.
You can do tracksuits or you can do hoodies and jean jackets.
I feel like I could use that.
Here is a photo of President Lula. We're just going to look at it.
No, what we need to do is get you a gaming PC.
Yeah. I think Matt and I might go
ultra-wide
in slightly
monitor.
Different directions in the how to de-isolate yourself spectrum. Matt was like, you don't understand how good it is.
You like
bro.
Make a meditation room, and I'm like, where's the, can we get a flat screen on the wall?
Be like, photo of like Neem Karali Baba, Lula, meditation cushion, massive flat screen gaming rig.
Then Jamie takes him to a noise festival on peyote.
Indeed.
It'd be a very funny
actually
show,
sounds like
actually.
A much more interesting show. I think we've already explored much deeper depths.
We'd turn everybody into schizophrenics.
Right.
You know, we got to use all the tools in our toolbox. Multiplicity of, what do they call it? Diversity of tactics.
Diversity of tactics. But seriously, put in Bill Barr, father, Dalton, Jeffrey Epstein. And go deep down that rabbit hole. And then look at, as this just embarrassing display between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump goes on, look up the Clintons and Haiti. And, you know, save your clap emojis.
Yeah, no crap.
I'm not here for it.
The some of the first demonstrators I saw at the DNC in 2016 were Haitian.
It's serious. It's monstrous stuff.
Like, they're still pissed at the Clintons about that stuff. Because guess what? It hasn't gone away.
Well, and it also goes back, like, there's multiple waves of, I mean, there's stuff that Clinton apologized about going back to the 90s while he was doing the current stuff. It's like, that agri policy was actually really bad, and I'm sorry. Okay, Now Sweet Mickey's going to be president.
Whoops-a-daisy-do-do-do.
Sweet Mickey's going to be president now. The guy who sings in a die. Look up Sweet Mickey. This is one more tangent, but it's fascinating to me. Sweet Mickey was the president of Haiti who was basically installed by Hillary Clinton. Essentially, he contested an election result. He had tight connections with the Haitian military. And he's a former, extremely entertaining and like literally like a guy who'd like sing naked on stage or in a diaper. And he was the pre-Trump. Like Haiti had a Trump like figure before Trump. And yes, Praz helped him get elected. Praz from the Fugees, who also Praz most recently was trying to get the guy who pulled off the Ito, who stole like $1 billion from a Malaysian sovereign wealth fund. Praz was writing a letter to the Justice Department to try to get him pardoned or something. So, yeah, a lot of weird stuff going on.
Is that a link to Aussie.com, I see?
I was wondering about that. Like, what on earth?
It really is a website.
When Hillary chose the president, I wonder if it's...
Oh, that's... Great. Yeah, that looks like the speech about, I mean, that's an article about Haiti, I believe.
Yeah. Is this a critical one?
If that certainly sounds like a critical title.
It's impressive. Go so Aussie.
Is the left doing entryism into Aussie media?
The left what is
like
Aussie?
Belly of the beast.
What is Aussie?
Remember that festival that Jamie went to with Chrisman and they did acid?
This is their website?
Yeah.
Oh, geez. Oh, cool. Good for them.
Hillary was the headliner. Watching Hillary speak.
I can't tell. I honestly can't tell if this is critical.
Like,
yet.
Tripping balls on acid.
Yeah, it's probably
got to
like
be
just
one
an
of the
act of
wilder
like,
experiences
powerful
in my
leadership
life.
On her part.
Which would frankly make it more interesting.
Yeah. I just even like she tweeted back at Trump, don't tempt me to run again. I was like, why? So he can beat you again?
Oh,
like,
and then she said, do your job. Like, no.
No,
how
don't.
Many times have I said we don't want him to do that job?
Oh, my God. Jesus Christ, people. Become a member of the Majority Report today. That's how this show happens. Check out justcoffee.coop. Support our sponsors.
It is critical, by the way. The Aussie article. So just to put it on the board.
Respect.
Good job, Aussie.
Good job, Aussie. Well done. They weren't like, in an act of totally empowered leadership and groundbreaking feminism, Hillary Clinton personally engineered a coup in Haiti. Last night on the Michael Brooks Show, we spoke with Heidi Sloan. She's a great DSA candidate running for Congress in Texas. Had a fascinating conversation with her about her farm and her vision to end homelessness and Medicare for all. Fun interview. Then we had a really interesting debate with Sagar and Jetty on nationalism versus socialism and different perceptions of China. We haven't done that sort of thing at all on TMBS, and I find most kind of online debates to just be sort of like tedious, like sort of dueling Google searches. But this was like an actual big picture conversation between two worldviews that, you know, at times have some weird overlaps, but actually real fundamental differences. And Sagar's a good guy. And that was a really fun debate. We also did a deep dive into what's happening in Ecuador, Rojava, and many other topics. We cover so many things on TMBS. I can never give you a full rundown. Patreon.com/TMBS. Become a patron today. We are well on our way to our first 3,000 patrons. Help us make it happen. And if you haven't yet, on YouTube, we're over our first 80,000 subscribers. We want to get to that 100K as soon as possible. Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Get your tickets. November 23rd, live show in Philly, World Cafe. Very excited about that. Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, I'm just going to read you the description because I wrote it and I like it.
Sweet.
So everyone loves Bernie Sanders and hates Angela Nagel. But when it comes to the enforcement of borders, their politics are basically the same. Using the power of historical materialism, returning guest Ross Wolf traces the origins of the modern day nation state, explains the limits of economic nationalism and social democracy in one country, which is to say all social democracy, and makes the case for why nothing short of global communist revolution is necessary in the long run to avoid a descent into fascism and horror. And you can read Ross's piece, Nationalism, Borders, and the State, at the Brooklyn Rail or MR Online, Also, coming up this weekend, oh my God, it's so soon, is the Goth Socialist Variety Hour with the Antifada and Pod Damn America, as well as special guests Matt Chrisman, Virgil Texas, Leslie Lee III from Struggle Session, and the amazing drag performer, Comrade Barbie. And that is Saturday at Littlefield in New York. So get your tickets. They're selling pretty well. They might sell out. So get it now.
Sweet. Matt.
Yeah, Literary Hangover. Check out, I just did an episode on Lydia Maria Child. She's an early feminist and abolitionist. And this week, getting into some witchcraft stuff. We're going to actually talk about the biggest witch hunt in American history.
Total witch hunt
in Salem, 1692. Yeah.
What they did in Salem, I thought was a disgrace.
I thought it was such a disgrace.
It was such a disgrace. It was a sublimated fear of women, and it was a total disgrace. Total hack job.
Yeah, so I'm deep diving into that in preparation for a Crucible episode. Also, for patrons, I'll be doing a George Orwell essay called Bookshop Memories. Which is him talking about working at a bookstore and how that changes your relationship towards literature.
That sounds very nice.
Very lovely. Very of this weather, I would say, as well.
It's a bookish weather.
It's very bookish weather. All right, folks, we'll see you in the fun half. Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you. You fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.
Hey, folks. Reminder, this episode is brought to you by Blinkist. The Blinkist app takes the key takeaways from thousands of best-selling nonfiction books and condenses them down into just 15 minutes for you to read or listen to. 10 million people are using Blinkist right now. It has a massive and growing library from self-help and business to health and history books. Check it out. Right now, you, as a Majority Report listener, can get 25% off your first year at Blinkist at Blinkist.com/majority. Blinkist.com/majority.